Hello and welcome to the Magic Life podcast. And today I'm with Tabby from Northlands. Hi Tabby, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm okay.
You're all right? So tell us a little bit about yourself. Introduce yourself to everyone.
I'm Tabby. I came to Northlands in February 2021. I was late diagnosed with autism and ADHD about 5 years ago. And the last few years have been kind of a process of really like trying to understand myself better, trying to grow as a person, and yeah, trying to have better insight into myself and understanding maybe why sort of traditional mental health treatments I hadn't really seemed to respond to that well, because my autism was kind of missed.
Tell me a little bit about your early life. Where did you sort of grow up, and tell me a little about early Tabby life.
I grew up in my family home. It's still my family home back in Surrey. So I live with my mum and my dad, and I've got a younger brother and a younger sister. So yeah, I was always a very, very quiet child, very timid. I didn't kind of mix well with others, and yeah, I was a dancer started dancing when I was about 4 years old. That was like my safe place for me. Like, that was my place where I felt like I could express myself. But I guess around the age of sort of the change to secondary school, I think is where a lot of my mental health struggles really kind of started. And possibly that came from the fact that I was actually autistic and I couldn't cope with the jumps from like junior school to a massive transition to secondary school, which I didn't really adjust to very well. And although I'd done well academically, I kind of kept it a secret how much I was actually really struggling, and that manifested in anorexia, which like I've had for most of my adult life. And I think that a lot of that came from the fact that I was actually autistic, and I think my body and my weight became something that I felt that I could control, and it became a way that I was able to communicate myself without verbally having to communicate with myself, if that makes any sense. And I think on reflection now, kind of when I look back, when I was admitted into eating disorder units and things, suddenly I had a peer of people that I had something in common with, even though it was just food and weight and things like that. Suddenly I had a core of people that I felt I had something in common with, which I think made it very difficult for me to give that up, because I didn't fit in with my peers around me. And I guess unfortunately, because the autism wasn't picked up, it gave me a label of being very complex, very untreatable. And I think it's only with hindsight I've been able to look back and think a lot of that had to do with the fact I think that I was autistic, and I was searching for like a community of people that I could fit in with, and unfortunately like that got me tied up in a system that kept me pretty unwell.
So what sort of age was you when you were sort of diagnosed with an eating disorder?
Well, my eating disorder problems, I'd always had problems with eating, and then during secondary school I started losing a lot of weight. I had an accident when I was 17, which affected my ballet, and my ballet was my life. So I was in a spine brace for a couple of years, and it was kind of when I came out of the spine brace that people noticed how much weight I'd lost. And I was diagnosed with anorexia. At the time, I'd never met anybody else with anorexia. Like, it wasn't like it is now, where it's all over social media. I'd never met anyone else with anorexia. And I was told that I needed to go into this unit. Obviously, my parents were devastated. And I thought it was just going to be an easy process. I would just go into hospital, eat, gain weight, come out, and it would be sorted.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I went into hospital, gained about a stone, thought I didn't want to do this anymore. And I think that's where my struggles really kind of began, because I was mixing with other people that had been in the system longer than me, that probably showed me the ropes a little bit, and I felt like I had something in common with them. And then I think, you know, I was, you know, there was a lot of other things that were also going on in the background, but I think it became a familiar thing for me. But, you know, I knew that I'd come out of hospital, I would think I had got better, the restriction would start again, the over-exercising would start again, I'd lose weight again, I'd go back into hospital. And if I look at it now, it was something that was very familiar. And if you look at the presentation of autistic females now, where they are now screening girls with anorexia, because 43% of them now have an autistic kind of profile, I think it became something that was safe. Obviously, it wasn't safe, but it was safe in that it was something that I knew. It was a routine. I knew that I went in, this is what I ate, this is what I did. I gained weight. I went through the process. I had a whole load of people that I had something in common with. I would go back out again, and with all the best will in the world, I would think I was recovered, and I would fall back into restriction again. And then when I was 19, I had my first actual big breakdown. I was in hospital for my anorexia, but I had a very big mental breakdown, and I went into a depressive episode. I was sectioned, which was pretty horrific for my family, and I was transported to a secure unit in a very, very old institution. The kind of barbed wire windows, barbed wires across me on 2-to-1 arm holes. My dad slept in the car park, outside, looking at me through the bars in the windows. I didn't speak for months and months on end. I didn't respond to anybody at all. And that was also the start of what I was also diagnosed with, was major depressive episodes. So I spent about another year in a very secure hospital, trying to recover from the depression. Yet again, tried to integrate myself back into life, but the anorexia kept coming back. And I guess throughout my life, although, you know, I did try to work and do things, all my work revolved around my eating disorder. They were all jobs either that revolved around food or revolved around exercise. And while I was working in that role, and I knew what the role was, I'd done the job really good, but then when I got home, I would fall apart behind the scenes. And eventually end up back in hospital again. I did go through a lot of trauma, like, throughout those years. And again, a lot of that trauma, I think, could have been avoided if we'd known that I was autistic, because many of the things were because I didn't understand that people were trying to take advantage of me, or I was perhaps talking to people that were going to take advantage of me. And it got me into some dangerous situations where eventually I ended up being fairly long-term sectioned for about 5 years, which was a very difficult time of my life.
So from, if we unpack a bit of that, from the beginning at school, you were, felt maybe you were a bit different at school, you're struggling.
I was always different. I couldn't cope with playing with the others. I didn't like touching things. Kids didn't really like me at their party because I'd sit under the table and I'd watch, but I didn't really understand how to play with other people. I know my mum always expressed concerns about it, but they always said, oh, do you know, she's just shy, she's just timid, do you know, she'll grow out of it. And I guess it was only when my nephew was born, and my nephew was displaying very similar behaviour. My sister had spent a lot of time working with autistic children, and she said, I think my son has autism. And at the time, my mum said, no, your sister was just the same. Anyway, Henry got his autism diagnosis, and it was at that point my sister and my mum said to me, we think you may be autistic. I was kind of quite shocked at the time, but I didn't know anything about autism in females or anything. So my sister said, like, let's just fill out the paperwork and see where it goes. The scores came back very, very high, and they said that they needed to, like, assess me further.
So this is in the school. You're realizing, how old are you at this point?
Well, I only actually received my autism and ADHD diagnosis about 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So throughout my life.
So that bit there where your sister and your mum are discussing that they think that you may be autistic, how old you were then?
That was maybe 6 years ago, 7 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Ago. So I was much, much later.
All right.
So throughout my life, I had spent my life out of hospital.
So going back to the bit where you're at school, and you're feeling that you don't quite fit in, and then you started sort of developing anorexic traits, and then how did you disguise that? How did you disguise your eating disorder from your family?
I guess I wore a lot of baggy clothes. I guess I danced a lot. I was a dancer, so my day often looked like getting home from school, going straight to the ballet studio, coming back home, maybe saying, oh, I ate while I was there, or my mum would have left food for me. I would pretend to have eaten the food and then put food away. I know my mum started to become increasingly concerned. Do you know that I wanted to take my food up to my room, and then it was obvious I wasn't really eating.
So why do you think you started wanting to control your food or control your weight?
It wasn't really a conscious decision. I guess I was very unhappy. I felt very alone. And I can't even really remember why I started to lose weight. It wasn't that I ever thought I was overweight or anything, because, you know, I danced. I just started to control my weight, and it got out of hand. I didn't really, understand what anorexia was.
Did you like food, or was it that you didn't like food?
I've always been very difficult with food. Like, my food anyway has always been like very much the same. So I guess I started to control my intake even more, and that became out of control until I actually stopped eating.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, it was a school psychologist that said, we need to refer you to see if we can secure a diagnosis.
So at that point, you don't realise you're anorexic, but you're just controlling food. You don't quite fit well at school. And then you started control food. People around you started noticing it was an issue.
Mm.
And then you got referred, and you then started to receive treatment, and you went into these units where they help you with your food intake or anorexia.
I mean, it was a very, very strict program when I went in there. I'd never met another person with anorexia in my life. I remember thinking, I've not got what you've got. But, you know, we were fed on very large quantities of food. It was very, very restrictive program where you were confined to a room, and you weren't allowed to leave that room until you had gained enough weight to
move
get
on.
Out. So, you know, I had to gain about 4 stone. So I was there a long while.
But what I'm trying to get to is that when you was at that unit, you suddenly found that you found a kinship with other people that had the same thing.
Yeah.
And then how did that manifest itself in your brain? How did you go, I've got a like-minded group of people that think the same way as me?
Yeah, I guess it, because I always found it very difficult to make conversation with people, I didn't really have much in common with my peers because I had very, very fixed interests that didn't fit in with my peers. Obviously, I was then with a group of people that were all talking about food and weight, and that were all like very orientated around food and weight. So although it wasn't my intention to stay ill, I think subconsciously it made it very hard for me to then move on in life, because I didn't really have a set of peers that I had anything in common with. So however much I would say, right, I'm going to try and do this, I'm going to try and do that, I would end up falling back into ways that were comfortable, which resulted then in me losing weight and having to go back into hospital. And I guess as the years went on, I became a lot more, I did become a lot more difficult to treat. I was a lot more difficult to treat.
Why do you say you were difficult to treat?
Because I didn't want to be treated, which resulted in sectioning and tube feeding. And, you know, it became very, very difficult, because the more I got into it, the more difficult it became for me to
break away
from it.
So do you feel like you was using the illness as an association to what you think you were?
I think it became an identity for me. Think for me, like, I didn't really know who I was without anorexia. And all I did know is that I felt very different from other people, and I think my internal world was very much, I'd grown up trying to reduce myself, trying to not be too outspoken, trying to not be too opinionated, trying to, you know, I'd always had my own very fixated ways, my own interests that were always just a little bit out of the box compared to other children. So I had this feeling where I felt I needed to reduce myself to fit in, and I think that got almost transferred onto my body, where because I didn't feel like I had a voice, I was reducing myself physically because I felt invisible in society. So ironically, I was becoming invisible, but when you see an emaciated person, it communicates something. You look at them and you think.
So are you saying that you wanted to be heard, or you wanted to be...
Unconsciously, it was a way of being heard, yeah. It was a way of vocalizing, I'm not okay, like, and I didn't have to open my mouth and say, I'm not okay. Mm. I don't fit in. I'd already sort of become more and more withdrawn, and my body said it all for me. And, you know, I did go through many years being a very, very resistant patient,
Well, I suppose, is that because you just didn't want to let go of your identity at that time? You aligned your identity with that illness.
I was absolutely terrified of weight gain. Like, I was terrified of any kind of weight gain. And because my weight became very, very critically low, obviously I was sectioned and they had to tube feed me because it was a state of life or death, really. And I was not willing to do it of my own free will.
So do you think your anorexia, as far as I understand it, and I'm obviously not a medical professional, but anorexia is a mental condition,
definitely,
right?
Yeah.
And then you obviously you're becoming resistant to the treatment. You're becoming difficult to handle. So, and you're maybe, were you trying to escape from the units and, or what were
I was. Yeah, I was very difficult. I didn't want to be treated. And by that point, you know, I was struggling with complex PTSD. I was having depressive episodes. I was very unhappy, you know.
So do you think that those additional mental health challenges were as a result of not getting proper nutrition? So your
I think a lot of it was I didn't have proper nutrition. I think because I became very distressed when I was refed, it would often lead to me having to be managed in a more secure hospital, and then my self-harming behavior became very severe. And I was moved to a trauma unit in Yorkshire. That place probably saved my life. It, like, for me, that was where I started to get a better understanding of myself. But even when I was there, everybody said there was something different about me from everybody else. And we couldn't put our finger on what it was that was different about me. But I couldn't ask for help. I couldn't make eye contact. I didn't cope in groups. I didn't cope with the noise. But my incidents didn't present in the same way as other people. My incidents always presented in private. They were always hidden.
Mm-hmm.
And most people would never even know that something had happened, which actually made my risk very high, because my behaviour became more risky, but I wasn't the kind of person that was gonna tell you, and I wasn't the kind of person that drew attention to myself, which meant that in a unit full of people that maybe all acted out in a very extreme way, I was a person that withdrew, and my instance would be more very isolated, which meant my risk level became very high, which is why obviously I was detained for a long period of time. Like, but I would say that when I was at the retreat, I gained a lot of insight, and that admission we had DBT. It was basically built on DBT.
What's that?
Dialectical behaviour therapy. And although I didn't ever fit into the EUPD diagnosis, I did find that DBT did help me a lot with interpersonal communication skills. But whilst I was there, they were still saying there was things that just didn't fit in my presentation with other people, and they had to kind of tailor make the program to help me communicate better. Things like, they used to give me like a stone that I used to pass to staff when I felt unsafe, and then they would pass the stone back to me because I couldn't actually physically ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was those things that now I can look back on and see that they were very much to do with me being autistic.
How did the sectioning happen?
I think my first section was when I was 19 and I went into a depressive episode. I stopped talking again. Do you know, I've had quite a few periods in my life where, even when I first came here, we had a period of time where I wasn't talking. And I do think, again, that was part of me being very autistic. But I was incredibly depressed. I was having quite a lot of traumatic memories and things.
Those traumatic memories are revolving around young Tabby at the time?
Not really, yeah. Through my adolescence more. Like, I didn't really have trauma growing up, other than the trauma of being a child that didn't really fit in with their peers.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess going through secondary school and things, that was like very traumatic for me. And then in my 20s, I had some very kind of abusive relationships again, which I probably got into because I was autistic and I didn't understand that these people were taking advantage of me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't really understand danger. I didn't understand social cues. I thought these people were people that cared about me, and then they took advantage of me. And I guess it began to just completely affect my mental health in a massive way.
I can see how that would spiral out of control.
And yeah, and then I think back in 2014, I became very unwell again, and I went into a full-blown psychotic episode.
You're still battling with anorexia at this time as well?
Yeah, I mean, my anorexia is a battle that I will battle with for the rest of my life. Although I would say that when my nephew was born, that was a turning point for me.
Why?
Because he's my world. And the day he was born, I held him and I thought, I'm never going to let this little boy sit on a lap that is bag of bones.
Mm.
And that, for me, that was the point in my life where I thought, you know, I'm never going to make full recovery, but I'm going to turn this around and I'm going to live for this little boy.
Mm.
Little did I know that Henry was the key to me finding out that I was also autistic.
How long were you in hospitals for?
A very long while. At one point, I was on section for 5 years, just being rotated from general hospitals, being tube fed to acute wards. I then went to a trauma unit for 16 months. But I never gained any weight while I was there. In fact, I still lost weight. I was then supposed to be removed back to an eating disorder unit, but then the eating disorder unit didn't feel safe having me there because they felt they couldn't manage my risk, which meant then I was back on an acute ward.
So, you know, from that point, you've left school now, right?
Mm.
You've gone into treatments, in facilities for treatments. Was there a point where you said, okay, I'm sort of managing this now, and you've gone in, because you said that you went into the workplace and you started working, and you said that you got your own flat. How did that all come about?
Oh, I'm a con artist at pretending that I'm okay, basically.
Right.
I'm a good con artist at pretending I'm okay. And I'm good at conning myself.
Yeah.
So, do you know, many times I would come out and I would be like, this is what I'm going to do now. So I got a job and I was working as a manager for a health food company.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I look at it now, an autistic person in a role that they know, that they're confident in, which also fed my eating disorder, because it was completely revolved around food. I excelled well while I was working, but I would still go home and starve and harm myself. So, but I was leading like this double life, which eventually caught up with me. Unfortunately, while I was working, I had something very traumatic happen to me.
What, in the workplace?
Yeah, our shop was robbed, and my Saturday girl was attacked in front of me, and after that I was written off work with PTSD. It was very traumatic.
So what sort of age is this now? What age group are you now?
I was in my 20s.
Yeah. So you've gone from school, you've gone to treatment centres, you're there 5 or 6 years, you're under treatment, and then you start to convince other people that you're better, but you're not really better.
And people knew I wasn't better.
Yeah.
But I tried to convince people I was better.
And then you managed to secure a job. Was that your first job, or was...
No, I'd always had like a Saturday job since I was 14. Like, there was always a rule in our house, 14th birthday, you go out and get a Saturday job.
Yeah.
But again, it was things like I couldn't travel. My dad used to have to take me into work. My dad used to pick me up from work. I didn't really mix well. There were things that caused me extreme anxiety.
Such as? Like just getting on a bus, maybe?
I couldn't get on a bus. It literally used to make me throw up, and I had like symptoms of agoraphobia from a very young age. But again, none of this was really recognised within autism.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess I then moved on. I got another job. I worked as a personal trainer. I worked as an aerobics teacher. Of course, amazing. I took 25 classes a week. Great, in the role, had mic on. People used to say, different personality. Soon as the class was over, I couldn't mix with anybody. I didn't know how to interact with anybody. But while I was in that role, I knew what I was doing and I was focused. But the thing was, is I was obviously exercising a lot. My weight was, you know, under 6 stone. And it was putting my organs under a lot of pressure, which sadly again, I ended up resectioned and I'm back in hospital again.
So you say that you were playing a role.
Mm.
You were someone else when you was that fitness instructor. You were someone else when you're working in the health food company. Did you adopt that role? Did you know that you were doing that?
Not really. No, I didn't really realise that I was doing that. But when I look back, all of my work was very orientated around my eating disorder, or they've been orientated around things that I have specific special interests in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I'm very knowledgeable in a certain area, like I can talk to an apple about an orange.
Mm-hmm.
But if you ask me to have small talk, if you ask me to even just go and sit in the front room with the others, I can't sit in there and make small talk.
Mm-hmm.
The anxiety it gives me is so unbearable,
mm-hmm,
that I have to hide away.
Mm-hmm.
But I could probably speak in a room full of people on a subject that I knew a lot about.
Mm-hmm. So is this if we've got a, you've got Tabby here, mm. right? Is there a second Tabby that you've sort of morphed into to battle your insecurities or your anxieties? And do you adopt that role to say, do you know you're adopting that role?
No, not really. I'm just, like, more often than not, I am the person that is still very withdrawn, that doesn't feel like they fit in anywhere, and it's very, very, for me, it's still very hard. It's mm-hmm. hard to feel like you don't fit in. I think the only thing is that once I received my autism diagnosis, it meant that I was able to understand myself better, and I was able to understand what things worked for me, what didn't, and I was able to accept, like, I'm not everyone's cup of tea, and, you know, and it's okay if I don't fit in with everybody.
Let me ask you, so, because I'm trying to give a timeline so people can understand the journey that you've been on, and then we're going to get to this aha moment, which is, by from what you've told me, is discovering that you're anorexic, autistic, right? Mm-hmm. So you've gone to work, you're doing these different jobs, and then you have a massive episode that then puts you back into being sectioned again. And then what, so how long was you there at that interval, at that time?
I was very unwell on and off for 2 years. So although I was sectioned for a little while, my parents were looking after me a lot at their place, which was obviously getting too much for them because they're actually quite elderly now. And I then moved to another supported living area, which, like, I was happy that I was settled there, but again, like, I didn't leave my room, I didn't come out, I wasn't functioning, I couldn't do daily living tasks, I wasn't mixing with anyone. It was heartbreaking for my mum to come over every week and to see that I was just living in a room with my curtains shut, I wasn't mm-hmm. coming out. And by then, I had been diagnosed again. I've been diagnosed by then.
But with what? Diagnosed with autism?
Yeah, and ADHD. And it was during lockdown, I had another big breakdown. And I made a very serious attempt on my life, which resulted in me being sectioned. And I was sent back to secure hospital again. And it was from there then that they said that I needed to come to somewhere that was autism specific.
Mm-hmm.
And they explained what my support needs were going to be, and they explained, like, why I had the struggles that I had.
So is this your aha moment where you go, it all makes sense to me now?
Yeah, it started to really make sense to me. And I thought to myself, like, now I understand why I found all these things so difficult all my life, because, you know, I've always had supportive parents. Like, my sister has been so much support to me, like, so much support to me. And it was always really hard for everyone to understand why is it not working? Why is it not working? Whereas now, I think, the missing part was that I was autistic, and obviously a lot of the treatment approaches are not autistic friendly. Hospitals are not good places for autistic people to be. They're loud, they're aggressive, they're very punitive, they're very restrictive, and all of those things probably frustrated me more and increased my self-harm, because it was a very distressing environment to be in.
So looking back at that now yourself, because you sort of understand yourself better, do you feel that had you known that you was you had autism at a young age, or that maybe you wouldn't have gone down the route of self-control with food and self-harm?
I don't know, because I think there's a massive overlap between my autism and my anorexia anyway, because I was always very difficult around food. But I definitely think if it had been picked up earlier, I probably wouldn't have got caught in the mental health system the way I had, and I definitely wouldn't have got labelled untreatable.
Mm.
Because I don't think I was untreatable. I think it wasn't the right treatment approach for me. And it isn't the right treatment approach for every autistic person that goes into the system.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are massive, massive failings in the system amongst autistic females at the minute. Like, they are not good places for people with autism to be. But I think for me, the real work came when I left hospital and they said, see you in 72 hours. I said, never again.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't been back in 3 years. I feel like I've broken that pattern. And whilst they still struggle massively, and I do still struggle massively.
When you say struggle massively, in what area in particular?
Still feeling like I don't fit in. I still struggle to find my voice. I still struggle with the aspects of autism that are less palatable for people. Like, people will bang on about autism acceptance, until you see an autistic adult have a meltdown.
Mm-hmm.
Or until you see an autistic adult who can't deal with the change so much that it paralyzes them. Do you know, it affects my everyday life. Still, it affects my everyday life. So, a lot of days I cry.
Mm-hmm.
I cry a lot. Do you know, I cry thinking, you know, I just wish the world accommodated for autistic people. And sadly, it often doesn't. We have spent our life trying to understand neurotypical people. And generally speaking, neurotypical people don't sit there and have the same amount. They don't waste the same amount of time thinking, what did that person mean? What did they say? What did that facial expression mean? What did most people are just living their life.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I will question every single interaction. What did that person mean? Did I give enough eye contact? Was I being rude? Was I smiling enough? Did my expression look flat? Like, it's very, very, very exhausting. Mm. And although there are parts of me that are relieved now that, yes, I know what my diagnosis is, do you know, even now, trying to get accommodations to adapt my world to make it a place that feels livable for me is often very, very hard.
Mm.
Because it is hard to live around somebody who has so many things they struggle with. They can't cope with noise, they can't cope with people, they can't cope with change. Their question is quite exhausting.
What, for others to deal with?
I'm sure it's exhausting for others. I'm sure.
Alongside yours.
It's very exhausting for me, but I am absolutely sure it's exhausting for others.
Mm.
Very exhausting. Because I will question everything. From the minute I wake up to the minute I go to bed, did you mean this? Did you mean that? Like, because the world still confuses me.
Mm.
It really confuses me.
So what do you think, what helps you now? Can sort of, have you developed sort of coping mechanisms with that, or strategies to help you deal with these issues?
I think people like the staff that know me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the staff that know me well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they will do things like, never say good morning to Tabby. Don't say good morning to Tabby because you will get back. It's not a good morning, you know. We'll do fist bumps. you know. I pretty much know what things will cause me to have a meltdown. Obviously, in a house like ours, you know, it's very hard to remove yourself from sensory overload because it's quite full on a lot of the time. I usually am able to say to people, do you know what, I feel that I'm going to have a meltdown. I feel like I'm going to have a meltdown. Sometimes you can use ice. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But basically, if I have a meltdown, I have a meltdown. We get over it. We just try to get through it.
What the team here, they sort of just try and help you as best they can through it.
I've got some staff here that have been here with me from the beginning, and you know, they have been amazing to me, and they know me really well. They know this is the protocol. If we go out, you know, it has to be done this way. It's done in this order. I have an extreme need for saying this.
Say that again, I didn't quite understand you there. Say that again.
Everything has to be done in the very same way. I have such a extreme need for saying this. So other people may just be able to go out and be spontaneous, but I have to have everything very, very planned. Even if my support changes, all of those things will build up and build up and eventually cause a meltdown. So I think with me, you know, we have to make changes very gradually, or, you know, try to keep things as much the same as possible.
So you find solace in your the routine of things.
And I don't function very well out of routine. I don't function very well in noise, and yet, you know, if I'm with people that are my people, that are my vibe, I can be a very funny person.
Well, we've always got on well, haven't we?
We have always got on well, yeah.
I'm interested to find out how you experience or how you introduce new things into your life that are uncomfortable. So, for instance, you've said to me just now that you like, you need that routine. Right? You need to know that this is what I'm going to do. We're going to get in the car this time. We're going to go here. We're going to do that. If you want to experience something different, how is that introduced? How do you do that?
I have to do it like very, very slow, even if it's a different drink. I might have to look at it a few times first.
Yeah.
And then I will probably go back and forth with it for quite a while. Then I might try it, then I might reject it a bit. And then it gradually becomes part of my routine. If we're trying to like integrate an activity in my life, we might have to do it kind of very gradually, make it into a routine where it's done very much in the same way, maybe the same member of staff, in the same order, until it becomes something that feels safe for me. Because the minute it becomes unsafe, like I fall apart, lose my confidence, and I withdraw again. So very much for me, everything that we need to do, we have to do in a kind of very gradual way to make it feel something that's like feels safe to me.
Yeah. It's familiarity, isn't it? You get used to a process.
And again, I'm not good at doing things with a lot of other people because my brain can't even focus on there's a noise there, this is going on there, that's going on, and I can't process it.
Yeah.
And even if I do something that I enjoy, I have to give myself processing time afterwards and even prepare for the fact that I could even have a meltdown just because it was overwhelming and my brain is trying to process it. And so I wouldn't be able to say, right, I'm going to do this today, and this today, because 100%, like, it wouldn't happen. I'd end up having a meltdown.
Do you get anxious when you think about, let's say you're going to do an activity tomorrow, and you start overthinking?
Yep, I get anxious just about leaving my room.
Yeah.
You know, like, for me, I'm probably one of the most anxious people
You know.
I am very, very anxious.
So, we've sort of put all your diagnosis in a box now. We've got hold of these. We now sort of understand what these issues are. Mm-hmm. And you've now started to learn about the coping mechanisms and the processes you need to be able to say, right, this is what I need to, if I want to go and do this and do that. So what are your things that you get enjoyment out of today?
I still got my doll hobby, which I probably started maybe around 16 years ago. Unfortunately, I don't invest as much time with it as I used to because my wheelchair has been broken for the last year. But I've created dolls for probably, about maybe
Tell me more
years.
About these dolls. What started you on the doll journey?
I've always been a doll person since I was a kid. One day I just was online and I saw somebody stringing this doll together and I just liked the look of it, followed a YouTube video, ordered a secondhand one, started restringing it. It became a hyperfixation. It took over my life. And then I used them to communicate. And at the time I was trying to recover from agoraphobia and I started using the dolls as a point that when I got out and I got to the goal, whether it be the end of the road, I made a photo story using my doll as a way of communicating, which meant I started a blog, which ended up getting like about 52,000 followers. And my dolls became a big way of me actually communicating.
So when you say communicating, are they like an alter ego then?
I wouldn't really say that. I think I created storylines attached to it. And again, this was before I actually realised that I had autism. But a lot of the storylines were about things that I hadn't understood while I was growing up, that I was projecting onto the characters of the dolls.
Mm-hmm.
And the dolls all represented kind of bits of me that I didn't really understand. Mm. And they have their own Instagram still. And I still go out, take a photo shoot every week, and there's a photo story that goes up on their Instagram.
We'll have to put the Instagram account on there, won't we? So are they still, sorry to cut in now, has the doll subsided with you getting a better understanding of your condition, or are they still
they're
there?
They're still the big thing in my life. I mean, I do think that is kind of part of my autism. It's part of my quirky special interest.
Mm-hmm.
All my special interests throughout my life have always been a little bit quirky.
That's all right.
You know, I collect miniatures, anything. It's just a little bit outside the box. But they're things that I really enjoy doing. And I do my art, which I enjoy. Journaling.
You did a bit of gardening as well, didn't you, at one point?
I did do a little bit, with Joe.
Yeah.
A little bit. Again, that was very difficult for me because of the touching aspect, but...
How did you get over that?
I didn't really. She gave me plastic gloves. It was a bit dramatic. But it was a good experience for me.
Yeah.
And I think it was something that I done here at a time when it was quite quiet. So I think it was like good experience for me to do.
So what sort of do you do on a weekly basis? You still do your dolls, you do your art, and you. So I didn't know you took photos of the dolls, and they got their own Instagram account. Has each doll got its own Instagram account?
No, it's one Instagram account.
What's it called?
It's called Life on the Top Shelf of Nowhere.
Life on the Top Shelf of Nowhere.
Yeah.
Is that the Instagram account?
Yeah.
All right. Can I nick some photographs from it?
You can.
All right. I need to repeat it. Life of the Top Shelf of
Nowhere.
Why did you call it that?
I have no idea.
Do you think there's some hidden meaning behind it?
I don't know. I don't know. As I said, many of my ideas are always very out of the box. I have no idea where that came from.
Yeah. It's a good name though, isn't it?
But yeah.
How many different dolls do you have?
I think I've got 27 now. Maybe more. Mm-hmm. A lot.
And they're all different characters. Mm-hmm. What's your favourite? Do you have a favourite?
I don't really have a favourite, no.
Is it because they look like your little babies? If you like favourite like, one?
Yeah, but also like I've created them from nothing. So each character, you know, kind of reminds me of a certain time and the reason behind why maybe I created that one at that time. And, you know, I have very, very fond memories with my dad when I was trying to get over my agoraphobia when my mum had gone on holiday in Australia at the time, and my dad spent a lot of time helping me get out of the house, taking me out with my doll to try to help overcome my agoraphobia.
How do you think that your diagnosis has affected your family?
I guess at first, you know, probably like any parent, they felt like, how did I miss this?
Yeah.
Wonderful, we've got a Diet Coke break.
Oh, Diet Coke break.
And a medication break.
You take medication with Coke?
Okay. Drink water.
But don't tell Lynn because she keeps making me try and drink water.
There you go. Thank you.
What was I saying?
Yeah, we were.
About my parents.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think like any parent, initially they were, how did we miss this? But I just remember when they first visited me here after I had been here maybe 6 weeks.
What, a magic?
Yeah. Yeah. And they came to visit me. And I just remember my mum crying and just saying, you know, this is the best I've ever seen her. And I feel like I can go to bed at night and I can sleep and not worry.
Oh, wow.
And my dad's a very private man, most men are. And he just said to me, do you know what? This is the best I've ever seen yet. And he said, you know, they're not on all those psychiatric medications anymore. Obviously, I'm on high dose of ADHD medication, but he said, this is the best I've seen you function. So I think for them, although it was difficult, I think it gave them some peace of mind that there were answers as to why things have been so difficult for me, because I had a good upbringing. You know, I never went without things. I mean, I came from a working class family. I never got it easy. I had very strict parenting, but, you know, it was really hard for them to understand what was so different.
Do you think they felt? Do you think they felt that they were to blame?
I think every parent that has a child that develops a mental illness, a mental illness that they nearly lose you to many, many times, and no parent wants that call that they've had to have many, many times. You know, we don't know if she's going to make it. We wake up and we're all sitting around the end of the bed thinking, you know, she ain't going to come round this time. And I wake up and I'm like, bloody hell, am I still here for, you know? I'm very angry, you know, for them to actually maybe realise it wasn't anything they did wrong. There's nothing they did wrong. it was something that I was born with. And in the same way, my nephew was born with it. And thankfully, his diagnosis has picked up at a young age, and he's received a lot of support from a young age. And my sister is just an amazing mum.
How's your relationship with your sister?
I'm very, very close to my sister. Like, me and my sister are very close.
Do you speak a lot?
Yeah, we do speak a lot. Mm-hmm. And I'm very, very close to my nephew. Like, my nephew is my soulmate. He's just... And he's the person he will always say to me, Auntie Jane, like, do you know what, Ray? I can do it. You can do it. Like,
so he's very supportive of you.
Yeah, and he gives me courage. He gives me inspiration. I look at him and I think, do you know what? If this little boy can overcome these obstacles, if he can go swimming, I can do it.
Mm-hmm.
If he, do you know, it gives me that feeling. You know, I look at him and I feel so proud of him. And then I just think to myself, like, I need to be there for him, because I'd hate for him to ever feel really alone. And I know that if anything ever bothered him, I'm the one person I know he would talk to.
Mm.
I know he would talk to me.
Well, maybe he knows what you've gone through and he can...
I mean, he obviously doesn't know anything about that, but we've always had a very, very close connection. So, you know, anything he will say.
So now, in this time of your life now, you're relatively stable, yeah?
Oh, we're not about stable.
Well,
but,
you're not in a secure environment, are you? You can go out. You've got your hobbies. You've sort of got to a place now where you're managing your conditions, if I'd like. Yeah, I mean they've not gone away, and they're probably likely not to go away.
Mm.
But you've got to a place where you can control or manage the situations. And the thing that maybe most people want is, I want some enjoyment out of my life. Are you getting enjoyment now, as best as you can?
I think there's something I need to do a lot of work on still.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I would say my last year has been incredibly difficult, incredibly difficult. And I have done well to avoid being in hospital. But I'm going to do my best to keep moving forward. I know there's a lot of things that I need to work on.
Mm-hmm.
I can't wait till I get the wheels sorted on my wheelchair.
Yeah.
Because
this year, you're getting a new wheelchair, aren't you?
Well, I'm getting new wheels on it. So this year, I intend to do some of the things that I know make me happy. Do you know
what? What are they?
I want to go to Kew Gardens. I love being in nature. I love being in places like Kew Gardens. I want to go to the lavender fields. I like being with nature and outside, where I don't feel, which is strange when I suffer with agoraphobia, but where all the noise isn't squashing me.
Yeah.
You want
some free open air space.
Yeah. And those things make me feel better. And I think.
So give me your top five goals for the coming year, this year, 2024. Give me top five goals.
Stay alive.
Right, well, we're going to do that one.
Stay alive.
We got that one bagged away.
I guess.
So you're getting some wheels. What will those wheels give you?
I think more freedom to be able to go out.
Okay, so.
I've not really been able to go out for the last.
So where's the top, give me the top two places you'd like to go to.
Royal Bitcalf, Kew Gardens.
Kew Gardens, right.
I'd really like to go to Hatfield House. I love museums. Yeah, just...
Okay, so we've got Kew Gardens, Hatfield House. Give me one museum.
Science Museum, back up in London.
All right.
Like that.
All right, yeah. Now we've got three so far. Give me some time frames. When's your new wheels coming?
I don't know. We're following that up again.
Do we need, just quickly interject there, do we need the wheels
do, unfortunately.
To achieve these things?
We do. Unfortunately.
So we can't go in the current wheels?
No. We can't even get that thing around Tesco's properly.
All right, okay.
It's bad. It's actually not even just for me. It's a safeguarding risk for staff.
All right.
Because...
it's falling apart.
And it should anything happen, and we've had like three...
Are we using that as an excuse?
No, we're definitely not.
You sure? Because no, I know you're bright.
No, we're not. No, because I have, in the last 2 weeks, made the effort to go up to the tree...
Because what I'd love to do, right, I want to make at least three of those goals happen relatively quickly, right? Even if it doesn't include the wheel, I don't want the chair or the wheelchair to be a barrier to get you to go to Kew Gardens, Hatfield House, or a museum.
Steal a shopping trolley.
Yeah, we can do that. Maybe you can sit on my back and I'll carry her.
But I'm pretty sure, like, do you know, it's a set of wheels. They just need to come change the wheels. That's all.
All right. And they're sorting that out, right?
Yeah.
When do you reckon it's going to happen? Soon?
Yeah, it should be soon because it's been 2 weeks.
Okay.
Since the appointment.
What about the coast? What about the seaside? Are you not a seaside person? Brighton?
Don't mind Brighton. I'm not.
Because you're a bit of a Nazi girl, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm not much. I don't like sand much. Mm. Brighton. I wouldn't mind Brighton.
Yeah.
It's a bit cold there, but...
yeah.
You know, I don't mind Brighton.
You seem like we got a good space, a good, happy place at the moment.
I feel motivated at the moment.
That's good.
I feel motivated. I think I've got a lot of work to do.
We've all got work, haven't we?
I think trying to make a bit of a comeback here, which is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm doing the best I can.
Right, I've got a question for you. What advice would you give the young Tabby? If now knowing what you have, and other people may listen to this, because this is the whole point of it, is to help other people. You know, you sharing your story might help someone not go through the trauma that you had to go through. What would you say? What words of advice would you give?
Be a bit kinder to yourself. Be true to yourself. Be who you are. Like, just be who you are. Doesn't matter if you don't fit in with everybody else. That you, like, you'll find your people. You'll find your people. Like, somewhere out there, there's a tribe for everybody. I'm not everybody's person, and everybody's not my person. But when I meet people that I know, are people I vibe with,
you're good.
I'm good. If they get my humour, we're good. If they don't get my humour, well, we're in trouble. But you know, at the end of the day, like, you know, not everybody is gonna fit in with everybody, and that's okay.
Yeah,
because that's the same for neurotypical people. Not everybody gets on with everybody. Not everybody has the same interests, and everybody has different abilities and things that they're good at and things that they're not so good at, whether you're autistic or whether you're not autistic. So for me, it's very much about self-discovery, about learning what does help me, and about working with people to help them to understand how to help me best to enable me to still access the things that I want to access in life in a way that accommodates for being autistic.
So is that the advice you give to the young person or young Tabby, say, be true to yourself. Just don't stress.
Well, I guess you will always stress, but at the end of the day, like, you are who you are.
And what about to family who may have a child that is maybe autistic and they're still discovering that? What would you say?
Just listen to them, be there for them. Try to learn, try to step into their world for a little bit. just step into their world for a little bit, try and give them some choices, you know, rather than
getting them to conform, maybe.
Yeah, like try to give them choices and some sense of control over things. Don't force things. Accept that meltdowns happen, but you know, there's damage limitation. Planning helps a lot of things, and it's tough having an autistic child, but it's definitely rewarding to watch a child with those challenges still flourishing and still achieving. And they can still achieve, and they will still achieve, and they will achieve things that will boggle your mind. You will think, oh, like, that is so out of the box, I don't know where they got that idea from. But you know, don't write them off.
Right, well, on that note, where we say don't write them off, we'll call it a day. Have you enjoyed it?
I have. It's been really good.
Yeah?
I'm really glad we did it.
Good. And then maybe when you get your new Hot Wheels.
Yeah.
And we go out to Hatfield, Kew Gardens, Science Museum, London Transport Museum, Southend, Brighton Pier.
What about Southend?
Right?
Like, Southend's a bit grey, isn't it?
Yeah, man. Right?
It's a bit grey.
We can have another chat.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tabby, for taking.
And also, yeah, thank you as well.
What are you going to say? With a swig of Coke.
A swig of Coke. Don't tell Lynn, because she told me to get some water. She told me I need to change my life. So. But yeah, no, it's been really good, and I've really enjoyed doing it. So thank you as well.
Thank you, Tabby.